the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. In a moment, Jeffrey Feldman returns to our program to talk about the language, the framing, and the strategery, or lack thereof, in Obama's health care reform effort. And then we're going to do something completely different. I've got kind of the summertime, you know, lingering. It's almost over, and we got to get our last fun in. Sam Barry's coming by in a little while with his harmonica, and he claims that he can teach me to play the harmonica. His new book is How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons. He's a wacky guy and a talented musician. We'll have some fun with that. And our final segment in today's program is a report on last week's staycation. That's right, like so many Americans, I couldn't afford to write the check for an airline trip to some exotic destination. So we gathered some listeners and we went to some of the, you know, prime tourist attractions in the San Francisco Bay Area, including Alcatraz, the California Academy of Sciences, and, an A's baseball game where the Yankees prevailed. Anyway, we'll report on that and let you know that you can have fun right there in your own backyard. As our pronouncer told you, the Peter B. Collins Show is supported by listeners, and I'm gratified at the support coming in from all over the nation and around the world, in fact, from Larry Doors and his wife Janet in Costa Rica, from Peter Contremus, who just sent me a note from Westwood, Massachusetts, and there are many others who will identify in future programs. But I thank you for your support, and if you're able to do so, just log on to peterbcollins.com and look for the You Can Help area, and there are many ways that you can support us. Jeffrey Feldman returns to our program. He is the author of Framing the Debate, Famous Presidential Speeches and How Progressives Can Use Them to Change the Conversation and Win Elections. Yes, it is a long subtitle. And he's also the author of Outright Barbarous, How the Violent Language of the Right Poisons American Democracy. And that book and its messages are particularly appropriate for the summer recess behavior of many Republican operatives. Jeffrey Feldman, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Peter. It's great to be back.
Good to talk with you. And before we get into your area of expertise, the framing, the language used around the signature initiative of the Obama administration that was nominally about health care reform, but now they've redefined it as health insurance reform, which at least is somewhat accurate. And I see that this team that pulled off an incredible election campaign just a year ago has not only been flat-footed and permitted the Republicans to gain the upper hand during this August recess, but I believe that strategically they blundered from the start by giving up certain bargaining chips that might have been useful about now or a month from now, in particular, single payer. Now, my bias is clear. I believe the for-profit healthcare delivery system has failed. I think that the insurance companies are the biggest source of cost escalation and price gouging in the delivery of healthcare in this country. And I want to move toward a single payer plan. It wouldn't happen overnight, but that's my ideal goal. I'm a realist, too, and I learned in the winter of 2007 when I went to the healthcare conference sponsored by Families USA and Senator Barack Obama spoke. I talked to a bunch of people from Illinois at that point, and they clued me in that he's not a single-payer guy. He had whiffed on it after initially supporting it as a state senator in Illinois, And so I didn't have any illusions that I was going to get everything I wanted out of this process. But I didn't think I would see a masterful politician like Barack Obama repeatedly negotiating with himself, giving away things to Republicans who were never going to vote for this damn thing anyway. And this phony sense of bipartisanship has been an albatross in this whole process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just starting with the single payer issue, I think that right from the start, what Obama was doing as far as communicating what he wanted health care reform to be was he was setting up single payer as the ideal that could never, ever be achieved because it would force us to switch radically from one system to another, and that would effectively derail the country. And so he put that out there very early on, and I think that the way that he presented it itself caused a lot of frustration because, you know, a lot of people at that time, early on in the debate, and this was before the town hall madness began, the big debate was, you know, should there be single payer or should there not be a single payer? You know, what should we do with this phrasing, the public option that was floated out there? And a lot of people believe, well, somewhere in Obama's head, there is the belief that a single payer system is better. So if we just push him on it, then we can actually get him on our side. So there's a lot of energy spent by people on the left in order to try to communicate with Congress and to try to actually get a message up through to the president that single payer would be better and so forth. But I'm with you, Peter. I don't think that he ever really believed in a single payer system. If you listen to what he said over and over again in the primaries, he really did believe in this behavioral economics approach to the health care problem, which was that you create conditions that encourage people to make the choice to purchase health insurance. And that was the problem that needed to be solved. There was a very clear alternative, many clear alternatives in the presidential election, particularly in the candidacy of Hillary Clinton and also to a certain extent in John Edwards, where it was a different model. The idea was that you put everybody on a system, you get everybody inside a system of care, and then you come up with very, very creative ways, trial and error, to pay for it. So there were two alternative models. On the one hand, Barack Obama pushing behavioral economics, and on the other hand, you had people pushing for fundamental social change to reorient our health insurance system to a system based on care, and then figure out ways to roll back tax cuts and so forth to pay for it. So ultimately, I don't ever believe that Barack Obama wanted a single payer mm-hmm. because he was inside a very, very different set of theories and ideas.
Right. And the signals were clear back in March when they held the first meetings at the White House, and John Conyers had to publicly cry, saying, "I wasn't invited." And at the last minute, they invited him, but the snub and the signal there were very clear. And I think that, again, if their goal was to come up with a health care reform package that would be seen as a political victory, and that's the most important goal of Rahm Emanuel right now, I believe he doesn't care much what's in the bill. He just wants it to say health reform of some sort and be able to claim a victory. And so the wheeling and dealing that's going on right now is par for the course. But my sense is that at the end of all this, we will have squandered what could have been a major opportunity for substantive reform for some minor improvements. And I'm not opposed to getting rid of the pre-existing conditions clauses that bar many people from coverage. But that's not going to help cover the cost, which is the real reason that there are 47 million people without health insurance.
Yeah, we're going to end up with the same problems that we had in Massachusetts, but on a much larger national scale instead of in one state. And the major issue is that mandates and reform measures, even if they're not completely toothless reform measures, even if they have some bite to them, they have been shown not to keep costs under control. And so we're going to end up with a situation where people still can't afford things, costs are still rising, and inevitably the quality of care will go down. So everything that the Obama administration claims that it wants to achieve will not be achieved unless they put in place some type of very robust public option, you know, a government alternative that attracts or is constructed in such a way that it attracts a very large number of people, thereby enabling this new public system to do exactly what everybody wants it to do, compete with private insurance, bring down costs, cover everybody, and begin to actually put forward a health care system that maintains the health of Americans rather than just bleeding them.
And Jeffrey, let me move now to tactics, because again, this White House team, people who really excelled in both the primary and general election cycle in 2008, have bombed. And I'm a little pained to make this comparison. But what I saw happen this summer is a lot like what Bush tried to do with Social Security reform. He barnstormed the country without a specific proposal, without a piece of legislation that he could say, this is my bill, this is what I want to do. And the Democrats, in one of the rare victories they had over the Bush-Cheney-Rove Republican machine, they beat back the attempt to privatize Social Security in some ways by using tactics similar to what we're hearing about death panels and other things that have, you know, no relationship to the proposals that are on the table. But they were able to frighten people about the prospect of privatization of Social Security. And the Bush team's failure to have an explicit proposal that they could say, well, yes, this is what it will do, and no, it will not do what they're saying it would, it sunk that. And so we saw the Democrats trying to avoid the mistakes of 1993, the White House written bill that was 1,200 pages and dead on arrival when it made it up to Capitol Hill. They said, okay, we're going to let the Senate and House committees form these bills and really write the legislation. Now, that in itself I don't think was a blunder. But by not getting the process wrapped up in time for this August wrestling recess, I think that they gave this huge and rather vague target for the Republicans to paint death panels and socialized medicine and all of these ridiculous charges, and they have nothing to refute them with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reference back to Bush's Social Security failure as an attempt to overhaul, I think that's a great comparison. And you know, we lose that because this fight has already been through so many phases. But initially, it was a political strategy to send the president out into the country without anything specific because they didn't want to have it wrapped around the neck of the commander-in-chief, because that's how they read the failure of Hillary Clinton's attempt previously. And so that was their entire tactic. But what they didn't count on was a couple factors. Number one, they didn't count on the fact that the Democrats in Congress are basically asleep on this issue. I mean, there's so many members of Congress who really don't know nothing about health care reform. And so there was no motivation, there was no momentum in the Congress to back up this notion that the president would essentially be out there up in front selling something that the Congress would be working on actively. And so you had, you know, all of the Democrats in Congress went and they pulled up these old bills and they tried to pull something together. And that gave the Republicans plenty of room to come to the conclusion that this was not really about health care, but this was about politics. And once Republicans realized that, then they kind of got busy doing what they do best, which is, you know, we used to call it swift voting. But, you know, what they did was just launch their main moral argument, and the argument being that government, you know, liberals use government to do bad things to Americans, and that's what they're conspiring to do here. So, you know, what that did was motivate a wide, wide coalition of people, libertarians, people who were Ron Paul followers, people who were turned off from the political system but watching Glenn Beck. They all went out ultimately, and they started to voice their opinions in these town hall meetings. And then once they injected into that, these arguments about Nazis, the arguments about death panels, really the argument had been reduced completely away from health care and just down to this kind of screaming match about whether or not government was going to harm us or help us. And in that, the Obama administration was, I mean, they were 100% flat-footed on this. I mean, in the beginning, they did not take seriously what people were saying in public when people said they didn't really see Medicare as a government program, but something that they owned privately, that they controlled on a personal level. Rather than actually listening to what people were saying and mounting arguments that could displace that, a lot of Democrats right up to the White House actually were making fun of those comments. They were not tuned in to what was going on, that it was a political fight, and instead they were just trying to flood the debate with lots of facts. More and more and more facts, which I think is still what they're trying to do today. And ultimately, you know, they just lost. And it really wasn't until a grassroots campaign came in that rallied around the idea of the public option as being really the line in the sand that things started to draw even again, although I think it's a little bit too late. But what was amazing about that grassroots campaign was that it took this concept that was essentially designed to distract away from single-payer health care. The public option was never designed to be something strong or good. It was a red herring to carry the debate for the Obama administration to not talk about single-payer. And when the grassroots on the left, it was, you know, bloggers and people on a state level, decided to really pressure their members of Congress to support a public option, suddenly there was a second moral argument out there that either you support a public program, a government program, against as an alternative to private insurance, or you are not backing health care reform. That's one moral argument. And the other one being, you know, if you're supporting this type of health care reform, then ultimately you're allowing government to take over our lives. And that's where we are now. And we've got two kind of effective framing techniques that are being used, and it's an absolute stalemate. And I think that in the middle of that, you've got President Obama just kind of wondering how he can pull off, like you said before, Peter, a political victory out of this absolute stalemate. Everybody is angry at him. It doesn't seem there's any productive way out of it for him.
And Jeffrey Feldman, there's so many aspects to this, but one of the things that I see, for example, is as there has been this battle over an undefined public option, and as it has been somewhat defined negatively by Charles Grassley and others reciting these Sarah Palin-inspired right-wing talking points, they have really failed to give us a nuts and bolts idea of what the public option is. And so we're fighting over phantom phantom bits of legislation. And this is a really bad way to conduct these things because, as you point out in your book, Outright Barbarous, we do have people who are willing to use any available means to poison the debate, not to advance it, not to win it, but only to block it and to poison it. And these the Democrats really seemed unprepared for this. And the outlines were very clear in the way that Sarah Palin conducted those rallies a year ago. And she has not dialed back, even though she's, you know, muddied up her own political career with this resignation as governor of Alaska. She's still very effective at using these same tactics that can only disable the process. They don't further it in any sense of that word.
That's exactly right. And I think that one of the causes for this blunder by the Democrats is that rather than looking at the political landscape, rather than learning from what had happened in the presidential election, exactly like what you described, that, you know, that Republicans are willing to use these extreme tactics, they're willing to throw blood in the water, they're willing to use the mob, what Democrats on the Hill did was they turned to pollsters who take people and they put them in focus groups. They remove them from political context. They ask them abstract questions. They isolate a specific demographic that they believe is the only demographic that needs to be won in order to advance a particular legislative agenda. And then they come up with these talking points that recommend to everybody in Washington, D.C., that they stick to a certain way of framing this issue. In this case, it was talk to people who already have health insurance, people who are middle class, people who are concerned about pocketbook issues only. And don't raise your voice. Don't get upset. Don't demonize the insurance companies. All these things, this was what the pollsters were recommending to people in D.C., all these things will turn off the voters that we need. And so even when Republicans were accusing the President of the United States of wanting to wage kind of Nazi warfare on the American public, even when the euthanasia claims were coming out, you had Democrats in Washington turning to these briefing memos, which said to them, if you raise your voices, then you will lose support for health care reform. So it's not just a matter of choosing the wrong words that the Obama administration and Democrats in Congress lost this. They also chose the wrong tools. They chose to go back to the same old failed approach to winning a communications war rather than looking at the need to really fight hard for this. I mean, Obama needed to come to the conclusion that the moment he started talking about health care reform, that a lot of people were going to hear fundamental social change and that was going to kick the register of the debate up very, very high. And he needed to take that very proactive approach right away. A lot of people that I've been talking to lately believe that he really missed the boat by putting priority over the banking bailout first, saying that, you know, in order to salvage the social fabric of this country, he needed to talk about going after health care first in order to really get the American people focused on the priority, on the emotions, on his own passion to pass this policy. But they really, really missed it. And so ultimately, what we're probably going to get out of this is something like, you know, a glorified patient's bill of rights, some toothless regulations over the insurance company, and then about, you know, 35 to 40 million people thrown into the marketplace
right.
For the insurance companies.
Yeah. and they're, you know, kind of Brer Rabbit here saying, oh, don't give us that public option. Don't give us no public. No, no, no. Because they're just waiting to be handed a whole category of new customers who will be required to buy their product when today they are not. And they're getting it all on their terms. And the real capper for me, the greatest irritant in domestic policy for me during the Bush era was the Medicare prescription drug benefit with the donut hole and the do not negotiate with the drug companies provision. And what did Obama do? He made a deal with pharma and Billy Towson, one of the sleaziest guys in Washington, to basically put in the same kind of language in these proposed bills that pharma will be left to its own devices. And we're just going to trust them, not to price gouge the American public. And this, to me, signals louder than so many other things the true orientation of the Obama team. They are here to preserve the healthcare industry, and while they will take rhetorical jabs at the insurance industry, they are cozy with them, and they are expecting the payback is going to be a huge wad of campaign cash for Democrats running in the next election cycle. And I believe that's what's driving the White House strategy, much more than trying to deliver on the change message and trying to really, work through this process, difficult and complex as I acknowledge it is, to come up with something truly meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what the healthcare or the health insurance companies managed to do was they had a fundamental insight, which was no matter what happened in the 2008 election, no matter how many millions of people turned out to support Barack Obama, no matter how many people cried as they watched him be inaugurated, the moment that he got into the White House, politics would revert back to lobbying and who controlled the media. And if you look what the insurance companies did brilliantly was they pumped tons of money into lobbying the administration and Congress over exactly what type of health insurance reform they would accept and would not block. They were extremely proactive. And they put an army of highly trained spokespeople into the media. I mean, the people that I have heard from the insurance company on the media say the most ridiculous things. It's just unbelievable. With a straight face, they say this. I heard a report on NPR the other day in which a spokesperson for the insurance company said that only less than one penny out of every dollar we spend on health care goes towards insurance company profits. And, you know, I heard that, and I threw once to throw something at my alarm clock radio when I heard it. But, you know, the point was that they put these people out there. You know, if 10 million people hear them say that and 2 million don't say that they're absolute crooks, then they have succeeded. You know, they understood how to hold the line in the debate, and it worked. And, you know, I think a lot of people who volunteered for Obama, who gave money to young Democratic members of Congress who really thought that there was going to be a fundamental different way that politics was conducted, they had a very, very rude awakening because they really thought that politics was about holding to your principles, but in fact, politics is about stepping into these old corrupt mechanisms that have their roots deep, deep into the system. And because the Obama administration never committed to undoing those, we were stuck with a process that looked like every other process, and I think that's going to have serious, serious ramifications for the support that he gets next time around. If you look at his numbers, completely separate from health care, Barack Obama has gone from having just enormous support in the Democratic Party and in the center of the country to having people peel away. He is now approaching the point where people are starting to worry and people are starting to talk about re-election, even in the absence of having any viable candidate on the right. And that doesn't mean he's not going to win election, but it means that he's really shown people in this healthcare debate that all his talk about fundamental change in Washington was just talk, and this is really more the same.
And Jeffrey, not to beat a dead horse, but the approach to bipartisanship that this president embarked on starting with his inauguration is admirable on an ideal level. But after 15 minutes of it, I'd had enough. When Judd Gregg snubbed him and said, no, I don't think I want to be your Secretary of Commerce. And by the way, I'm going to vote against your stimulus bill. It really became very clear to me that there was no basis to pursue this. And the energy and effort that the Obama team has put into courting the three Republican senators, Grassley, Snow, and Collins, to try to get them to step up and support this is not only misguided, but the real energy should have been put into the recalcitrant Democrats. My own Senator Feinstein from California, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Ben Nelson. These are people who are not likely to support this president's effort, whether it's got a public option or not. And I think that he really needed to impose some party discipline early on and called Ben Nelson over to the White House and said, now, Ben, you and I may not agree 100% of the time, but if you're going to be a Democrat, I demand your vote on cloture. You can oppose the underlying bill, but you need to be with me to get those 60 votes we need to close debate in the Senate when it comes to critical issues like health insurance reform, as it's now more accurately called. And the failure to do that has left the president vulnerable on multiple flanks. And I don't think that that's something that can now be overcome.
I don't think it can either. And in fact, I think that this whole bipartisanship mistake was something that he made even before health care. I think that with the banking bailout, when they were trying to right the financial markets, I think that that's when he began to lose that block of Democrats in the Senate and that he needed for this particular battle. And I don't think he realized how much damage he had caused himself until he turned to this prospect of having a government-run program in which he needed to invest a certain amount of resource, a certain amount of billions every year for 5-10 years in order to fundamentally change health coverage in this country. And I think it was that combination of disagreement from those centrists in the Democratic Party and the mounting discussion about how much we were spending in order to do the bailout that really caused them a big panic when they went to negotiate this kind of thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think that what Obama abandoned was he abandoned that notion that he was communicating with a nation of idealists, of young idealists, and that he was speaking for them in contrast to speaking for the system. And I think that it was, I'm not exactly sure how he managed to abandon that so quickly, but my suspicion is that it is the chief of staff, that ultimately the chief of staff is in a very different mindset than the presidential election was, that you've got this kind of Clintonian view of things, that you achieve small compromises in the short run, and that you talk about them as being long-term gains once they've happened. You know, that's what Bill Clinton did. I was just at Netroots Nation a couple weeks ago where former President Clinton came and said that the small changes that he had put in place 20 years ago were finally coming to fruition nowadays, 20 years later, and then that's the type of progress that we needed to understand and needed to back and so forth. That's okay if you want to argue that way, but that is a fundamentally different way of seeing the world that Barack Obama used in the presidential election. And by switching, I think he's lost millions and millions of people. I think they have yet to realize how many people they have simply turned off. They began to reactivate this Obama for America network that they created, and I think they've got substantially reduced numbers. They're having a hard time getting people to turn out, having a hard time getting people to repeat their muddled messages, and ultimately their grassroots campaign has been rife with infighting rather than with that real unity of message, that real presence on the streets that characterized their efforts in the last election. So it is disheartening on many levels, and I think ultimately there's going to be a bitter pill that people in the country on all sides are going to have to swallow, because they are going to pass something, because Rahm Emanuel does have the ability to get things passed no matter what. They are going to claim it as a victory. Mm-hmm. They are going to say that things are better than they were before. And at that point, there's going to be a lot of outcry about exactly what we are going to expect. And in that vacuum, we know what's going to happen. The Republicans are going to come in, and they're going to define it, and it's going to be defined in ways that are shocking, offensive, that make you laugh at first, but it's going to cause all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. Jeffrey Feldman, at your blog, frameshopisopen.com, you posted a response to the president's it's now a video and radio address on Saturdays, and he and Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius have been very consciously backpedaling from the public option. And as we've already said, this is not clearly defined, and this is happening at a time when they're also battling back the firestorm of idiocy in terms of the so-called death panels and these other phony claims about bills that haven't even fully been shaped. And it just strikes me that the president is once again negotiating with himself, and that this is not a time to be sending up trial balloons about what we're willing to compromise away. It is a time when the president should be carefully defining what is required for him to sign a bill and what would trigger a veto from President Obama.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand about their strategy, you know, it's this two-bill strategy that they're trying to run. And so Obama is trying to do two things at once when it comes to that phrase, the public option. On the one hand, he wants to not lose the progressive bloc in the Congress, so he's using that phrase, public option, to signal to progressives in the House who have gotten a lot of pressure from the grassroots that, yes, he supports the idea of a government program to compete against the insurance companies. At the same time, he's trying to reassure the Blue Dog Democrats in the Senate that he is not going to hold the line on the public option because what's most important to him is keeping costs down. So he's trying to do two things at once and then run a real kind of backstage strategy down the road, one that Howard Dean has explained pretty well, where they can use procedural measures in order to get a public option in theory passed either through the budget or some other way with fewer votes, I think 50, a simple majority rather than a filibuster-proof majority. That's way too complicated for the public to understand, though. And so what you've got is a president who doesn't commit to anything. And so I think that the weekly address last week was a classic example of that. The big story of the week in the health care debate was the public option. Everybody wanted to know whether or not there was going to be a public option. And given the opportunity to communicate clearly with the voters on that issue, he didn't. And so that's why I drew attention to it. It is amazing how many people actually do listen to and go over the transcripts of the weekly address now that they're on the internet. A remarkable number of people do. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very influential moment for him, and he's left confusion in his path rather than clarity. I mean, at this point, he could define the public option just about any way he wanted.
Yeah.
In an attempt to say that he firmly believes it. You know, personally, I believe that he should have gone to one of these remote area medical free clinics,
mm-hmm.
Of the kind that they give out in San Diego, and he should have stood there with homeless people and people who are underinsured and who are scared and said, this is unacceptable in America. I stand for a public option to make sure that no one has to go through this humiliating process again. That would have been enough of a definition for everybody, because everyone would have understood that public option means Americans get the care they need without being humiliated. And that would have been enough. But he refuses to do that because he's got himself caught between two losing propositions. You know, people that are uncomfortable with where he's going on both sides, and he just refuses to choose.
Now, Jeffrey, I, for one, continue to kind of rein myself in and say, this guy's really smart. He's surrounded by smart people. He has a terrific sense of timing that he exhibited in the campaign last year. And there were many times when I was yelling at my television saying, come on, Obama, engage. Take McCain on directly. That's not how he does things. And so I try to look at alternate scenarios. And he's vacationing in Martha's Vineyard. And Ted Kennedy is on his deathbed at Hyannisport. And so one of my dreams of the moment is that Obama will go to visit Kennedy, and on his deathbed, Kennedy will say, don't sell out, don't give in. And that Obama could come back, and as we start to refocus after Labor Day, and when Congress comes back into session, he could lay out a much more explicit definition of the overall package and the public option in particular, and that something could be salvaged from the mess that we see right now. Can you give me any hope there, or do you think that this die is already cast?
What a difficult position you put me in. I have to dash your hopes, Peter. I don't think what you're talking about is the president embracing something that I would call a core symbol in this debate, that taking up, you know, as a focus of the discussion, something very, very symbolic, ending suffering, you know, wrapping his arms around people in need, standing with people who have been financially ruined, standing at the bedside of someone who you know, is dying of cancer because they couldn't get health care coverage, something symbolic, something that stands for the entire debate, that he comes out in favor of that. And, you know, I got to say, in watching this president speak week after week, he has resisted taking that symbolic approach in this debate. He has repeatedly gone after debunking myths, throwing facts about people. He likes to talk about, likes to use the phrase affordable quality health care coverage, which sounds like something you'd find on a health insurance pamphlet in the waiting room of a doctor's office. I mean, he has not reached for that symbolic aspect of political debate. And by contrast, the Republicans have gone for that, you know, like flies to honey. I mean, they have talked in these big, vague, but powerful terms. I mean, we have to admit that when the Republicans talk about there being death books, or death panels, as vague and as easily debunked those are, they are powerful symbols. They reinforce in the minds of Republicans and a lot of people who don't have party affiliation this fear they have about Democrats bringing change in this country that will mean government takes over your life and ruins things. So I'm concerned that Obama is not convinced that that's the way to go and that he simply will not reach for that symbolic type of debate, that instead he's going to come back from his vacation rested, refreshed, and he's going to put forward one of these, you know, 15-point consumer protections bills that are going to be clear, but people are not going to understand how this is going to really help them, and that it's going to pass with a little bit of fanfare, and he's going to move on very quickly to something else. So I think there's going to be a lot of disappointment. In the end, bring this around to a completely negative note. I think in the end, consumer protections are good. I think that we do want those.
Yeah.
But it will leave unresolved this question of costs and the uninsured. And no one really believes that this is going to be the end of it. We're going to have to revisit this again in another few years, and we're going to be faced with a much deeper problem, which is massive debt, people going, you know, massive personal bankruptcy as a result of this, and a lot of frustration.
Jeffrey, finally, I'd like to ask just your thought about an appropriate Democratic response to the allegation of death panels. Because, number one, that's not a part of the legislation, even if you imagine it in its worst form. And number two, I argue that we already have death squads, and they are run by the insurance companies. And on a daily basis, they make determinations to deny people coverage, often with life or death consequences. And yet they're just seen as, benevolent or at least benign individuals. And this is something that already exists. And yet the Republicans are allowed to talk right past that. And the Democrats don't really challenge the whole notion of death panels except to say, oh, it's not true.
Well, I have written about what I believe should have been the leading point in this debate all along by Democrats, which are these, and I mentioned them earlier in our discussion, but these remote air medical free clinics run by Stan Brock, who was a great spokesman for the need for healthcare reform. You talk about people desperately standing in line at 2 in the morning, driving for 6 hours, in order to get a poker chip to be one of the 300 people who come and get physical exams, people who live desperately afraid of the slightest problem in their health situation or that of their families. That is something that is incredibly cruel and needs to come to an end. It fundamentally violates our vision of America as a free and open society. So when people talk about death panels, I think you really need to focus on the absence of care for so many Americans. And that those remote air medical events, if people have not had a chance to see them, I've got a video of them from a CBS 60 Minutes spot about them. They are heart-wrenching, and they are 100% true, and it is just, it's something that's been going on for a long, long time. It's longer than the economic downturn. And, you know, ultimately the response to the emotions of the death panel comment are the emotions on people's faces. These people break into tears at the prospect of sitting in a chair to get their eyes examined, to have breast cancer exams, to have prostate exams, to have basic dental exams for their kids. And these are people of all walks of life. This is middle America. These are outside large urban centers. So I think that in order to push back, I mean, a lot of Democrats make with the death panel issue is to push back with emotionless facts, and nothing happens. I think we really need to pull out the passion behind why it is that we want health care reform, which is to end this humiliation that Americans live in, this fear that people have at not being able to get the basic care that they need in order to participate in American life. So it's out there, and I really encourage people to take a look at those events. There was another spot on them by CNN a while back. There's been some spotty coverage of them, but it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that your listeners will feel that their hearts are changed. I mean, stuff that they're already committed to, they will feel an argument that is very passionate well up inside of them. And if they use that, both in face-to-face discussion and in their writings or letters to the editor, you'll find that it works incredibly well. It rallies both voters and it rallies elected officials, and it silences people who are against these types of changes.
Jeffrey Feldman, thanks for your comments today. The website frameshopisopen.com has regular commentary on issues like this. And I invite you to read Outright Barbarous, his most recent book, subtitled How the Violent Language of the Right Poisons American Democracy. Jeffrey Feldman, thanks for joining me here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks so much, Peter.
This portion of the Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for PBC listeners. And now, for something completely different here on the Peter B. Collins Show, we welcome Sam Barry, the author of a hot new book called How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons. And this is the first book I've seen with a threat right there on the cover. Buy my little brother's book or I'll give you a noogie. And that's attributed to Dave Barry. Is he really your big brother, the columnist?
He really is my big brother.
Yeah?
And we play in a band together, as a matter of fact, called the Rock Bottom Remainders, an all-author band that no one should ever have to pay to see.
Right. And were you one of the ringers brought in to provide actual music so that other people like Amy Tan could just kind of, you know, play along with percussionist or, you know, something like that?
I mean, I am a ringer. There's three of us who are really musicians. But I also like to say that I was in by double nepotism in that my wife is the founder, Kathy Kamen Goldmark, of the band, and my brother is the lead guitarist, such as he is, lead guitar.
And what's it like to play with Joel Selvin, the longtime rock critic of the San Francisco Comical?
Oh, I have been in the band for like the last half of its career, but I've known the band its whole in his whole glorious career. And one of the funniest things in the band was the critics' chorus, which is unfortunately not playing with us as much anymore. But Joel was one of those critics, Dave Marsh. Back then, believe it or not, Matt Groening was a rock critic before he's still with the band. But, of course, Matt has gone on to other fame.
Well, he's got to count all that money from The Simpsons.
Exactly.
Poor guy.
But what was so...
Life is hell.
Exactly. Life is hell. Matt seems to be having a pretty good time there. And the three, these critic chorus, the band would hand it over to them, and they could neither clap nor dance nor sing. It was just so wonderful to see, the renowned rock critics of America.
Critics know how to go to a bar, get a drink, and get somebody else to pay for it.
That's right. They're all great writers, but...
And who is the most talented member of the Rock Bottom Remainders and might come as a surprise to us?
How do you mean that, the most talented? Because, I mean, we're talking about some of the premier writers in America. You mean musically?
Musically, correct, yeah.
I think Roy Blunt Jr. Leads the pack because he can't sing at all, but he's so great in that southern drawl coming out and introducing us.
Right.
And when Amy Tan puts out that fake cigarette in his eye, nobody does it better than Roy Blunt Jr.
Now, I brought my harmonica today. And in your book, How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons, see how I plug it for you?
Yeah, thank you.
Mention the full title?
I've never heard my book described as hot. I mean, you kind of had me going there.
I have previously failed simple harmonica lessons from Lee Oscar and Charlie Musselwhite. And they're two of my favorite harp players in the world.
You mean those guys actually gave you lessons personally?
Or? Yeah, Lee Oscar was promoting his harmonica line, and I see you're a patron of his.
I've got
a few, Lee.
And if you flip the book over, he endorsed it.
Yeah, he blurbed.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He's a good man, and his harps are great harps. Yeah. No, you're just, I'm just saying, Lee and Charlie, two of the greats.
Mm-hmm. Let's, I want to whip out a tune here from War, which was Lee Oscar's band.
Right.
And when I first came to California, which was 33 years ago this month, the radio station I was working for was promoting a concert at Spartan Stadium in San Jose. And War opened for the Doobie Brothers. And it was like this, you know, kind of ultimate California 70s rock experience sounds without like the Eagles, gratefully.
Great show. Yeah, it sounds like a great show.
And this has always been one of my favorite songs, which includes a lot of serious harp work by Lee Oscar. It's called Gypsy Man.
Yes.
And if you want to blow along with it, you're welcome to.
No, we'll listen for now. But I'll do a little something for you after.
Okay. I mean, they eventually start singing, but really the lead vocals are the harmonica.
Yeah.
In the early stages of this song.
Yeah. Lee was kind of an experimental player. He still is. He's somebody who uses the diatonic harmonica differently than most people do. He's one of the people who pushed what it can do. Of course, it was originally designed to do simple German folk songs, and look where it's gone. And Lee is one of those guys who pushes the envelope. He also is a guy who came up with different tunings, which you can buy from Lee Oscar harmonicas.
Mm-hmm. Now, why do you say he pushed beyond the diatonic? That's technical lingo. You need to explain that.
You know, you're right.
We need subtitles here or what?
No, we won't need any subtitles. But, you know, the basic 10-hole harmonica that most everybody has in their drawer, even if they don't play it.
That's where this was. Yeah. It was in a drawer. I found it yesterday.
Can be played in other keys. And
Rocky's getting excited.
Rocky's excited by the Rocky will tell you. Rocky is agreeing with me. Rocky's on my side about
this. Yes, he is, of course.
Yeah. Actually, Rocky's staring at like it looks like a small bug on the rug, and he's really upset with it.
Well, you have your harmonicas displayed there in a case on the floor next to you, and there's a good chance he'll try to pick one up and chew on it.
There we go.
Yeah. Settle down, Rocky. It's just a harmonica.
He's looking at something that's not there. Was Rocky been drinking?
Yes. It's early, but he has.
So Lee, definitely, you can play the harmonica in these different keys. And just a quick example of that is, you know, you can play the traditional O Susanna style harmonica, but to sound like one of those blues guys.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing the same harmonica. That was the same harp, but played in a different key.
Yeah.
For you musicians out there, it's modal playing. But harmonica players call it positions, first position, second position.
Now, I noticed that I still just kind of hold this like a piece of corn.
Yeah, yeah.
But you actually cup the harmonica, and then you wiggle your hands.
Yes.
Imagining that it amplifies, but it actually does something, doesn't it?
It does do something. Some of it's show. You remember the great Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee?
Yeah.
He would, like, go... He would wave his hand around wildly, and some of that waving was show, and I do some show, too. But but the basic part of it is very real. When you cup the harmonica... And there are a lot of ways to do it. It's not like this isn't the violin. You know, there's not one way that you must do it.
Uh-huh.
But you get it fully cupped, and you're playing in. It's as if you're playing into a sealed container. You get that muffled tone.
Mm-hmm.
Then you open it up, and you get that.
Wow.
And then you can ask for your mama.
And there is no school for this, right? Harmonica is a kind of oral tradition that is passed down from one player to another, and some of it's just picked up by observation.
I would agree very much. I mean, I've learned from other harp players, and I wonder if this is an instrument that's better off not having a school devoted to it. But yeah, you're right. You're right. It's very much a folk tradition.
Right. But is there a website where I can go for 42 steps, you know, with the little video tips?
There's a lot of stuff. You could buy my book. There's a lot of stuff online, which is very cool. I like the mom and pop thing. So I'll tell you a mom and pop. One is coast2music.com. And you can learn a lot about the harmonica there, and you can also buy a lot of harmonicas there. But they're like in Ohio, and they're a family-run thing. And then for very exotic...
Watch it. I'm from Ohio.
There you go. Yeah. My dad was from there. He was a Cleveland Indian fan.
Oh,
he tells you right there.
I'm from Cincinnati.
Oh, sorry about that. The
why I left. you know enough.
beautiful town.
Republican machine town with excessive humidity.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah, and racial divide. The I would say that you can go to a, if you really want to get deep into the harmonica in like heavy duty, where there's a thing called overblow.com. I send people to that, www.overblow.com, because it's so over the top, intense, but it's very cool stuff. And you can see just how far it's gone. If you've ever heard of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones.
Sure.
Well, Howard, when you talk about somebody pushing what this major diatonic, the little 10-hole harps, like the Marine bands, can do, Howard Levy, who played with them as the original harp player with them, is the guy who's done it most, and he's famous for the overblow technique. And you can play on this for you musicians out there. Now, a chromatic scale for three octaves, meaning every note on the piano for three octaves. It's very cool. You can do a lot with these things. Now, but I like to just teach people how to have a little fun with them.
Right.
I focus more on that.
And in your book, To Prevent Censorship in This New Age of Puritanism, you describe blowing, which is...
Yes.
And instead of using the word suck,
yes,
which could be, you know, misconstrued by the NSA when it shows up in an email or
they
something.
They might think we're having a good time or something. You know.
You use the term draw.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I've had trouble with, Sam, is I was trying to play single notes, and on the blow side, I can do okay, but I don't understand how you put your tongue in one hole and then draw in to the adjacent hole.
So are you using... There are a couple of ways to get a single note. I'm going to quickly teach you the pucker method, which is just to go like this, like you're Mick Jagger, you know?
Okay.
And you're going to kind of whistle into the harp. And try and focus on one hole. You did something there, Peter, which everybody does.
Looked at it?
They look at the harmonica,
right,
and it's a natural thing because we're so visual. But in fact, this is an instrument you feel.
I should tongue it.
You don't need to. I'm just playing like this. Can you get to one? There you go. You had one note there for a second. It would take a little work. You could. That's two. Let's start.
I can't get just one. I'm trying.
Oh, yeah. You can do it. I know you can do it. I've made hundreds of, if not thousands of people do it. But we're not gonna force you to do it here on the air.
Okay. If I start on the end. How that?
Yeah. It's easy on the end, right? Here, go down to one blow. Let's do one blow. And one draw. Now go back to one blow. Now slide to two blows. Sorry, let's go back to one blow and slide to two blow.
Okay.
That's me, not Peter.
Air.
That's now, okay, Peter.
Now, I did bring a little backup air here.
Okay.
I've got a spray thing. And I have had a little trouble here, actually, getting that to work.
Peter is right now demonstrating that. Peter's demonstrating he has too much time on his hand.
Well, no, this is
he has one of those spray things that you clean
computers,
keyboard with.
Yeah, you get rid of the dust, right? So
I've never seen anybody try to play the harmonica with one of those.
Well, it cannot be automated.
And now I can see why.
It requires a human.
That's right. That's right. You won't be replaced.
Well, that's good. Now, do you recognize this? This is an Australian rock band from the 80s called In Excess.
What?
And they flew Charlie Musselwhite all the way from Sonoma County, California to Sydney, Australia to blow and draw.
Very cool.
And this is like one of those remixes of a song that was called Suicide Blonde.
It's cool.
Yeah.
I love the effects. They have beautiful effects on there.
All right, well, that rocks us a little bit. Let's talk about the origins of the book. First of all, 5 years in Omaha as a Presbyterian minister. Were you secretly practicing harmonica all the time then?
I plead guilty, yes. No, I've been playing harmonica since I was like 10, 9 years old, something like that.
Okay. So what happened in Omaha? Was it good, or was there a warrant?
I think it was good for Omaha. I don't know if it was so good for me. No, I just, I was a Presbyterian minister. That was a big chunk of my life. it's shocking, really, to think when you examine Dave and my life, but our father was a Presbyterian minister.
Who knew?
Really? Yeah. Huh. And so was our grandfather.
Now, did you grow up in Florida? I always assume the Barrys are from Florida because that's where Dave worked.
Right. That's Dave's thing. And I could tell you the story behind that, but in fact, we grew up in Armonk, New York. Armonk, New York is... We're sitting here in lovely Marin. Armonk's a little bit to New York City like Marin is to San Francisco.
Well, isn't Armonk a corporate headquarters like for IBM?
You got it. Yeah, they came there while we were living there. It was a lovely little town, and then they ruined it. No, they didn't. They came along and changed the town some.
Kind of like the way Texaco went into Ecuador?
Yeah, exactly. sort of the corporate takeover time, yeah.
They left huge ponds of sludge with loafers with tassels on them, right?
That's right, yes, and gray suits just screwed all over the place.
So, Armonk, New York, and how many Barrys are there? Were there?
There are four of siblings, four kids, and my sister Katie, who lives down south, Dave out in Miami, and my brother Phil in Atlanta, and I'm in San Francisco. We pretty much have the nation pinned down. That's
right.
The way we feel it.
Yeah, yeah. And is everybody talented, artistic?
Yeah, I mean, well, assuming,
I mean, I know
assuming
about
you
Dave.
Think I am, and
well,
Dave is.
Dave, yeah. Dave.
Yeah, we're. I think we're all funny, and we're all. We think we're all funny, my sister was had a lot of talent, wonderful singer, and my brother Phil is probably funnier than either Dave or I, but he's much shyer, so the world will never know.
And what does he do?
He was a computer programmer for AT&T, and he lives with his lovely wife, who is an ICU nurse down there in Atlanta, and their three daughters.
Mm-hmm. And are you the only one with real musical talent?
I think that, no. Phil was a, Phil was actually took a degree in music and could really play like Bach.
Mm-hmm.
And he composed. And I learned a lot from Phil, although I always wanted him to show me how to do blues shuffles on the piano. And that's, I went in a different direction, obviously. And he's the one who gave me a harmonica. He just sort of threw it at me the way big brothers do, but little did he know.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody sang and played music in the family. We grew up in the kind of civil rights era sort of environment, and my father was a lefty and working in inner city New York, and we heard a lot of great music, and that influenced me, I know, and all of us. And so music was something you did for joy, and it was something we did around our house. Mm-hmm. We've always loved.
Yeah.
When I just saw Dave, the Remainders were playing up in Idaho, I'm sorry, at a benefit at Sun Valley. But when we were together rehearsing, which such as we do, afterwards, Dave and I started singing songs. We almost always do. We just love singing and playing. It's just something we grew up with.
Uh-huh. Now, this is a fun book to read. Even if you never pick up the harmonica and decide that it's not for you, one of the things that you're emphasizing is taking risks, allowing yourself to be even the butt of a joke as you attempt to try something new. And you also contrast the regular way with the playful way.
That's right.
On many occasions in the book. Now, tell us a little bit about this. Is this a result of this, being defrocked and finding a new kind of liberation and discovering the playful dude inside?
It might be. I think it's more like that. I always have believed in that. I believed in that when I was in the ministry too. I just think that people, life is serious enough, and without. Emphasizing the seriousness too much. And I think sometimes people take themselves so seriously that their whole lives go by and they never notice that they could have had a little fun along the way. They could have enjoyed the thing. So that is, I think that's always been a part of me. And, I'm preaching to myself. Believe me, I know I need to hear this just as much as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like something like vacuuming the floor the regular way, you talk about that. In the book, I talk about you just get out the vacuum cleaner, you plug it in, you didn't really want to, but you have to, and then you vacuum the floor methodically in lines, straight lines, and then you have to put it away, maybe empty the bag. And, whereas you could do this in a more playful way. Actually, I have a video online if you ever want to see it on YouTube on Sam Barry TV. of me doing this. You put on a tuxedo or an evening gown. Mm-hmm. You can go see which I chose. And and you get out the vacuum cleaner. I actually present, knock on the door where the vacuum cleaner is and present it with a bouquet of flowers. Mm-hmm. And then you you plug it in. You bow or curtsy to the vacuum cleaner. And then you pretend you're Fred Astaire or Ginger Rogers, and you waltz around the room.
Including climbing the walls and dancing on the ceiling?
Yeah, do it all. And, you know, whichever one of you is in heels doing it backwards, that's fine. And and you dance around gracefully while vacuuming the floor. You know, why not have some fun while doing these things?
Yeah. Well, here's a list that I pulled out here. You contrast buying your harmonica the regular way, which is three steps. You go to a store, you ask the clerk, and you pay for it. And your five-point system is to put on a 1940s-era zoot suit, dark sunglasses, slick back your hair, and saunter to the nearest blues club. And then you add, men, there's no reason you can't try this, too.
That's right.
Talk to the harmonica player about his instrument during a break. After you sober up, download some Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee songs to listen to on your way to the music store. Four, when you get to the store, head to the drum section and start banging on everything in sight. Try out the guitars and the keyboards. Be sure to crank up the volume. When you've got everyone's attention, head over to the counter and buy a harmonica.
There you go. You know, it's not as efficient, but I think it's a lot more fun.
Yeah. And on one of these lists, you didn't have a number five, but you printed it anyway because you said these lists often look better.
With 5 points, yes. Yeah. It's like self-help books. You got to have 3 or 7 points.
Now, you work in publishing. We won't expose exactly for whom and exactly what you do, Mr. Murdoch. But
I just say I work for Carper Hollins, but that's not the real name of the publishing house.
But is there research? Have they done focus groups about these, you know, 10 ways, thin thighs in 30 seconds, more orgasms?
somebody has. You know, I think
lists. People buy lists.
They do.
The Walakinskis published the book of lists.
I know.
Eight or 10 of them, for God's sake.
I know. And, you know, bullets seem to really help. You know, as in typographical bullets. Bullets are really great.
Right.
They're in. People see bullets, they figure, oh, that's organized.
Yeah.
That must be the truth.
Oh, boy. You also go on at some length about your own lack of swimming skills. But you were at Camp Sharperoon?
That's right, Camp Sharperoon.
Where is Sharperoon?
Well, my dad ran these camps for inner-city kids, so we were like the only white kids among a bunch of black and Puerto Rican kids from the city. And actually, kids from the city generally can't swim, or in those days, you know, I don't want to date myself, but we're talking 60s, so I couldn't swim so well. But I, you know, was from the suburbs, and so I felt somehow less of a man at 7 years old or 8 years old because I couldn't swim, you know. And I really wanted, I felt like I was a coward. And, you know, when you're a boy, you often have, or a girl, you have a lot of, you put a lot of pressure on yourself about these things that nobody else is necessarily pressuring you about. And I felt like I was falling down on the job because I hadn't learned how to swim yet.
Yeah.
And so one day, I think you're referring to the story, I was at this camp. I decided to go. Oh, and there was a guy there who was encouraging me. He said, let's go out swimming. And he was like my buddy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to admit to him I couldn't. So one day I just went out and I jumped off the dock. I said, I'll try out for the deep end swimming. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know. Mm-hmm. So they let me do it. And this was a murky brown lake in upstate New York. I jumped in, and all of a sudden I was going down, and I was looking up, and I saw that sort of ring of sunlight as you go down.
Right, yeah.
And it was quite an extraordinary experience. I realized that I better start swimming.
Confess your sins?
It was like, whoa, I could drown. So I swam, and I think they caught on quickly, but I made it. I did it. So it was, one of my brave acts in life, small but brave victory.
And you're suggesting that we should all pick up the harmonica, take the plunge, and just do it.
I think so. And, you know, you don't drown. The advantage is there's no risk of drowning when you play the harmonica.
Uh-huh.
So,
why don't you just play us a song?
Oh, all right. I'll play
something that we would like.
I'll play a little something that you like. This is a old, since we're talking about these matters that are spiritual, I'll play you something called You Got to Move. It's an old gospel blues. It is. There's a blending sometimes of different music forms. This is a little gospel, a little blues, And Sister Rosetta Tharpe did a great job of it. But, of course, that great gospel band, the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. made it most famous.
Okay, and then could you segue from that into Room to Move, the John Mayall classic?
Okay, I was going to do before when you were talking about Lee Oscar. A lot of people don't know that that's harmonica yeah. doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's easy to do. I could teach you how to do that if we could get you playing a single note.
Right.
So here's You Got to Move.
Let the record show. His eyes are closed.
The better to see the Lord. You've got to move. You've got to move. You've got to move, child. You've got to move. 'Cause when the Lord, he gets ready, or she, you got to move.
Five ways to overcome stage fright the playful way. Join an amateur choir, chorus, or barbershop quartet. Go to a karaoke bar. Imagine everyone in the audience wearing stupid-looking boxer shorts. Them, not you. Put on a costume and sing in front of the mirror or to your dog. Thanks, Rocky.
Yeah, Rocky.
Or imagine your shrink singing in really stupid-looking boxer shorts to your dog.
Yeah. Then you have to go get another shrink after you do that. Eh?
Yeah. And let's just touch here on some of the best-selling harmonica records of all time. Country, Bluegrass, Charlie McCoy, Mickey Raphael. I don't know that.
Mickey Raphael. You do know him. It's just you don't know his name. He's okay. The guy who played with Willie Nelson. So every time you ever heard harmonica was Willie Nelson.
Okay. Jimmy Fadden. Delbert McClinton I've certainly heard of.
Jimmy Fadden played with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Mm-hmm. Then in the Rock Zone, Stevie Wonder, Springsteen. Does Jagger play the harmonica?
Yeah, although he plays well, not great. And mm-hmm. that wonderful Miss You da, 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 is not him. That's Sugar Blue, who is a great harp player. But yeah, Jagger played some pretty good harp along the way, like on Midnight Rambler.
Okay.
Midnight Rambler. Yeah, this is Sugar Blue. The story goes that they just, the Rolling Stones were wandering around Paris, whatever they would be doing. And they heard him
looking for fresh blood.
Yeah, one kind of wonders. And they heard Sugar Blue playing in the subway. He's an American, but he was in Paris playing in the subway. And he's a great harp player.
Yeah. Okay, Bob Dylan. Now, did you hear the recent story that Bob went AWOL and got picked up by the cops and didn't have his ID with him?
Did I hear that story? I should tell you that I belong to a thing called the Society for the Preservation and Advancement of the Harmonica, or SPA, which is, I think, a wonderfully bad name. But SPA, because it sort of sounds
I'm
like...
I'm calling the acronym police right now.
SPA kind of sounds like an alien life form in, like, a Star Trek episode or something. But they really are a great... They are a group that started in the 1960 in Detroit and just somehow by default became mm-hmm. the National Harmonica Organization. And to talk about an underground sort of word-of-mouth thing. And they have one of those old-fashioned mail, you know, email groups that you can get on and you see everybody's email.
Sure.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And there were about 500 emails in a row about this Bob Dylan incident. And it led to this endless discussion about whether cops are good people but on the other hand, citizens can be annoying. And is Bob mm-hmm. a good player? And
what was he doing at that house?
I don't know. I don't think anybody had the facts. That's what I love about these conversations. Nobody has the facts.
In that case, we turn it over to Nancy Grace and she'll convict him without any facts.
There you go.
That's all it takes.
But Bob is Bob's an interesting character and he's, people have always been tracking him. And, you know, I mean, there was a guy who used to go through his garbage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dylanology has been with us as long as Dylan's been with us.
Well, and he's been working on his mystique, and it works, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think he knows what he's doing, and he's pretty crafty.
Yeah.
pretty crazy.
All right, also on your list here, we mentioned Lee Oscar. Neil Young, Heart of Gold, is one of his great tunes. And just by way of a friendly amendment,
yeah,
my pal Norton Buffalo playing here with Steve Miller.
Oh, did I not mention Norton in this book?
I don't see him
yeah,
here.
I think you're right. I'll have to, because Norton is my friend on Facebook. I think he's one of the great players there is.
He is, yeah.
He's a local hero, too, along with Charlie and Mark Hummel. You know, these are the big names in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And so I'm sorry. That's just an oversight because love Norton.
Let's have these remaindered then. And
yeah, pulp them all right now.
Yeah.
Sorry, don't buy this book. Even I'm the author, and I'm saying, Norton is a great player. And probably in the popular world, he'd be best known, of course, for playing out there with Steve Miller. He also did, I bet you in Marin, there are a lot of Bonnie Raitt fans everywhere.
Sure.
And she did a version of Runaway, and that's Norton Buffalo playing this wonderful solo where he switches through four keys of harps.
Mm-hmm.
He is a very, very gifted man. He has also been on my wife's, the show, radio show my wife produces, West Coast Live.
Yeah.
More than
Sedge Thompson.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Norton's been on there. I've met him there. He's a great player.
Yeah, he really is. Well, Sam, this is a really delightful book that you wrote, and I like your playful approach to life and to learning the harmonica. And I just need to close to make sure that there was full disclosure with you for you before your recent marriage. Do you know that your wife was running an escort service?
You know, actually, that's how I met her.
Well, really?
I was thinking we could start it up again. It could be fun.
Well, just so people understand the linkage here, Kathy Kamen Goldmark ran the first West Coast escort service for authors.
She was the best in the business when
she
used to do it.
And when they came to San Francisco, she would, first she did it herself, and then it got so big she was hiring other drivers. But it was this personal service, the author hauler, as Calvin Trillin has referred to it.
Kathy said she drove him to it, you know, is what is her motto. I mean, Kathy's gone on to be an author and a producer of the West Coast Live, and we're working on a book together, actually. It's going to come out next fall.
Can't wait.
Man.
Sam Barry, thank you very much. Once again, the book is How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons. It's out in soft cover from the publisher called Gibbs Smith. And it's a lovely book. I recommend it to you. You'll have fun no matter what you do.
All right. Thanks so much, Peter.
We're on vacation till the start of the fall.
Here's a report on my recent staycation right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is aimed at people who live around here and can't afford to go away for vacation this year, like me. If you live elsewhere and you can afford to visit, please do. California, or as we now say, California, is broke. And we have a fossilized action movie star playing governor, so please bring lots of cash and please, please spend as much as you possibly can. So we invited some listeners to join us as we hit some of the big tourist attractions right here in my own backyard. Patty and Mike drove up from L.A., Chuck and Tony and 11-year-old Nick flew in from Detroit. To get them oriented on day one, Captain Collins took them sailing on the bay. As the afternoon fog rolled in and the winds gusted up to 25, oh yeah, it was blowing. We showed them the Golden Gate Bridge, the waterfront towns of Sausalito and Tiburon, and Angel Island and Alcatraz, all from the water. Then on day two, Chuck, Tony, and Nick took the Golden Gate Ferry to the city, did a walking tour of Chinatown and North Beach, while Kathy and I took Mike and Patty to Sonoma for some wine tasting. We wowed them with the Jacuzzi Winery. Now, that's the same family that brought you the Whirlpool Tub, but it's a very, very different product line, I'll tell you. They make an amazing array of Italian varietals, some that you don't see from wineries in America at all. And their wines are very impressive. It's a beautiful facility there. So if you ever have the chance to stop by, it's right in the Carneros region of southern Sonoma County, just up the road from the what we used to call Sears Point, the Infineon Raceway. We also tasted some great recent Pinot Noirs at the Shug Winery, which is right up the street there. So that was a good afternoon. And then we drove to San Francisco and met the advance team over at the waterfront. We took the night tour of Alcatraz. That's the prison island that many locals have never visited. This is my third visit, but it's been almost 20 years. And Alcatraz, especially at night, as one man put it, is...
It's very creepy.
Yes, very creepy. And while I've visited many prisons, the sound of the slammer is always dramatic.
That's the sound of the slammer.
Yes, it certainly was. And what did people think coming off the boat after the night tour of Alcatraz?
Excuse me, was this your first time on Alcatraz?
Actually second, really.
Yeah? What did you think?
It was not as scary as I thought of. It was actually really impressive.
Uh-huh. What about at night? Was it scarier at night?
A little bit. When I walked in, the sky was still, like, gray with sunlight. When I walked out, it was, like, pitch dark.
Yeah.
All I could see was the lights across the ocean.
And what did you think?
I thought it was great.
Yeah?
It was her idea.
Where are you from?
New York City.
Yeah? It was cool. Yeah? What was the best part for you?
When they closed, when they did this, I don't know what it's called, but they closed the cells.
Right. The door.
Yeah.
It was very, very nice. It was very creepy. I felt very isolated, very lonely, and I'm glad I wasn't an inmate during the time that the prison was open.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Creepy, good English. What was the coolest part?
Probably the jail cells.
Yeah? What else did you see? Did you like the boat ride?
Yeah.
What did you think of Alcatraz, sir?
I'm glad it wasn't.
Is this your first time on Alcatraz?
It is. I've lived in the Bay Area for, I hate to admit it, it's over 25 years, and I've never been to Alcatraz.
What do you think?
It's pretty amazing, actually. When you put it in the context of history and the way it looks and the way that life was conducted there, it's a snapshot that really was very interesting.
What do you say to people who've lived in the Bay Area as long as you and never gone to Alcatraz?
I would say that you're missing an important part of the Bay Area history, and I think it would be really important to make the trip.
So you can get more information at AlcatrazCruises.com. That's AlcatrazCruises.com. And whether you're local or visiting, those tours do book up ahead of time, so do try to plan it in advance and avoid a prison break heartbreak if you want to visit the Rock. Well, on day three, we took the wackiest tour that I've ever been on an amphibious duck. This is a motorized boat vehicle. You drive around on the streets. Mark was our guide and driver, and he was a pretty funny guy. Kept the comments coming over the loudspeakers and played a lot of funny music along the way, too. It was very well orchestrated. It was embarrassing, though, because they gave us these little duck call things and kept urging us to blow in them and quack as we were going through, the downtown financial district, also at Union Square. And, of course, I kind of hunkered down in my seat. Fortunately, as far as I know, nobody recognized me as I took the tour. And over near the Giants ballpark in what we call China Basin, they actually drove this thing right into the water. And that's when the quack part, the duck part, came into effect. And this little craft started to cruise along past the large ships in dry dock and over for a great view of McCovey Cove and the Giants ballpark, which is named after a phone company. I can't remember which one. Anyway, it's a lot of fun and an irreverent way. It wasn't stuffy, and while we did hear some of the history and interesting factoids about San Francisco, it wasn't kind of the boring tour bus thing that you might think of. So check it out if you want, bayquackers.com. That's bayquackers.com. That afternoon, we went to the California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park. And this was my first chance to see the new facility, which just reopened last fall. They spent more than $450 million rebuilding what had been the Steinhardt Aquarium and the California Academy of Sciences facility. And it is really spectacular. I have to say, I want to go back and spend more time because there were areas that we moved through pretty quickly that I'd like to linger in. And in particular, this four-story rainforest. The first story is the underground aquarium, and you can actually walk in a glassed-in area underneath it and watch the fish as they cavort and do their business. You see the reef. You understand the full connectivity of the ecosystems in the rainforest, starting with, of course, the sea life and the waterways, then moving up into marshlands, wetlands, and then, of course, trees of the rainforest. And by the time you get to the top floor, you walk a circular path and move upward. You are surrounded by butterflies, beautiful live butterflies that just flit all around you. In fact, they pat you down when you leave this area, not worrying that you've, you know, done something illicit or have a weapon, but to make sure that you don't exit with any butterflies hanging all over you. Also, this new building features a fascinating living roof. And we went up to the roof and talked with Andrew Ung of the California Academy of Sciences about what makes it special.
We're here now on the roof, and you just described that there are essentially seven hills that the architect Renzo Piano envisioned here. And we're looking at a very natural California flora, and it's just flora. I don't see too much fauna. Describe a little bit what this means in ecological terms. Why is this a green roof and not just a beautiful architectural feature?
Well, using native California plants is a strong statement in that we believe that these plants evolved here. They don't require any kind of inordinate fertilizer or water. Of course, they do in the beginning to get established, but you know, it's much better than using invasive species or ornamental species that require 24-hour care.
And some of these features, you say, we're looking at what are round skylight apertures here on the roof, and these are computer controlled and they open to ventilate the building?
That is correct. We have a central computer system called our building management system. We have weather stations on the roof that feeds data to that computer system, and judging by that data, the computer knows when to open the skylights and which skylights to open.
And what kind of maintenance is required here to the growth?
We have a staff of two full-time groundskeepers and some volunteers. They come around and pull weeds, sometimes by hand, and they water when necessary, they fertilize when necessary, mostly to get the plants established. We're still very young. This roof is very young, and so there is some maintenance required. Hopefully in the long run, it will be lower maintenance.
And what do you expect it to look like in 2 years? Will it just be more deeply grown, or will some of these produce bushes and larger plant life?
Well, hopefully the plants won't get too big, because then they'll become very heavy, and our roof is meant for a shallow, medium, and lighter weight plants.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, your guess is as good as mine, because this roof is, it's living, it's evolving as we speak, and what it looks like now, covered with all these purple plants, is not what it looked like 5 months ago. It was more green then, but now the purple plants, the self-heal, have bloomed and really changed what the roof looks like.
And is this something I should try at home?
Well, living roofs are not that easy to put on pre-existing structures. So if you're building a new home, definitely consider it. But if you want to put it on your old home, you should probably get a lot of advice from contractors about how to bear the weight of plants and rocks and water.
And what's the insulation value of this whole earthen installation?
We estimated by computer models that it would keep interior temperatures about 10 degrees cooler than without a living roof. And the roof itself is about 40 degrees cooler than a normal asphalt and tar roof. So it's decreasing what we call the urban heat island effect, which is cities have higher temperatures because you have this concrete and tar that is absorbing heat and radiating it out and holding on to that heat.
That's Andrew Ung from the California Academy of Sciences. A lot of great information on their website, calacademy.org, calacademy.org. Then that same day, we returned to the waterfront and shoved off on Hornblower's dinner cruise. on the California. That's a spacious ship with a full bar, restaurant, and a dance floor. They had a duo that entertained us with some good music and some patter about the landmarks that we passed. And again, they gave us good information, but didn't overdo it so that people weren't subjected to a lecture or something boring. The sun was setting through the fog as we dined on steak, chicken, seafood. The crew was very welcoming, and the captain gave Nick, the 11-year-old, a tour of the control room. We got some great photos, too. Here's some comments from people we found aboard the California, the Hornblower ship on San Francisco Bay.
So, Tony, what did you think of the Hornblower dinner cruise on San Francisco Bay?
Oh, it was wonderful. The food was delicious.
Yeah? And what did you think, Chuck?
I enjoyed the ride in the boat.
What was the high point for you?
Everybody else's food. It was great.
And what about the scenery? What did you think of the views?
They picked up all the highlights of San Francisco. It was wonderful.
So Hornblower has a special offer for Peter B. Collins Show listeners. It's a dinner cruise for two for just $99. You can get the details at peterbcollins.com. Just look for the information on podcast 29, and we'll have the details and a link to Hornblower right there for you. Now, on day four, we had to rest because, well, we'd been doing a lot in a short period of time. Then in the afternoon...
Let's go!
A 7:05 start, what we call a night game. Featuring the Oakland Athletics and the New York Yankees. Young Nick is a Yankees fan. He was thrilled to watch A-Rod and Jeter work out from about 27 rows back along the first baseline. And the A's have done a great job of creating a small ballpark feel inside the cavernous Oakland Coliseum. We scarfed down a bunch of dollar hot dogs that helped offset the whopping $17 parking fee. And the young A's fought hard. We stayed to the very end of the game, which the Yankees won 3-2. And I got to sit next to a guy named Pastor Vega, a Brooklyn exile who offered an array of prayers for his Yankees in between cell phone calls from members of his congregation. One of whom was calling from prison. He told a couple of people, "I'm at Yankee Stadium. I'm watching the Yankees at the Oakland Stadium." The colorful people who populate the ballpark. It's always a lot of fun. Well, then on day five, we sallied forth to Silicon Valley. First stop was the Google campus, where we got a tour and free lunch. And if you have a way to wrangle this, do it. Google has created an attractive modern-day plantation where workers are treated like owners and every appetite is catered to. Now, we only got to inspect two of their five cafeterias. We tasted sushi, pizza, a garlic lamb entree, pot stickers, various salads, a macaroni dish with four different exotic cheeses, their deli sandwiches, and some healthy stuff, too. And lots of sugary things, although I didn't see the employees there overindulging. But we had the trademark San Francisco ice cream treat called the It's It Bar, and I haven't had one of those in quite a while. Every work area at Google has a micro kitchen, and one building has a coffee bar that's more elaborate than any Starbucks that I've seen. Employees are provided breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. They restock those micro kitchens apparently a couple of times a day. And I guess they work harder and longer as a result. Nobody was complaining. There were two cool things I saw at Google. In one lobby, they projected a list of recent search topics in multiple language. And it's fascinating, a kind of voyeur, you know, looking over the shoulder of somebody entering search terms. And some of them were X-rated. Some of them were just dull as could be, and some of them were in Chinese or other characters that I couldn't read. But it was a pretty cool thing to see. And they also had a Google Earth projection dome. and it projected your search area all around you. And with a joystick, you could navigate in all directions and zoom into somebody's backyard, presumably your own, or maybe somebody else's too. So if you can get an invitation, you need to know somebody who works there. Google is a great stop in Silicon Valley. And our final destination on our staycation was the Great America Theme Park in Santa Clara. It's on the site where the 49ers want to build a new football stadium. In late August, the park was not crowded. The lines were short. We rode most of the roller coasters and then got soaked on a log flume ride. And while they do have one wooden roller coaster, Great America is a collection of corporate-branded rides based on movies and TV shows. And to me, it's pretty doggone tacky. I'm glad we ate well at Google rather than pay the high prices for junk food at Great America. Now, they do have water slides and other hot weather rides. We weren't really dressed for it, and it wasn't excruciatingly hot that day. So, you know, there are some good things there, but there's a whole lot of merchandise and way too much junk food. If you have the time, I recommend you drive over Highway 17 to Santa Cruz and check out the Beach Boardwalk. Over at Santa Cruz, it's right there on the beach itself. And it's an old-style theme or amusement park like Palisades Park. A couple of great wooden roller coasters. And just a whole different vibe. So take it from PBC. Don't deny yourself a vacation this year. A staycation can be lots of fun, and you discover great places in your own backyard. I want to thank the folks on Alcatraz Cruises, the Bay Quackers, the California Academy of Sciences, Hornblower Dinner Cruises, and Great America and 98.1 KISS FM, as well as Pam Pitts at the Oakland Athletics. Really appreciate your hospitality and all the efforts you made to entertain our group, and we hope that people will choose a staycation in the Bay Area and visit some of these attractions. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.